Welcome to episode 5 of B2B, the business club. Our guest today is Gary Holladine. Gary, thanks for your time. Thanks for taking time away from your busy schedule tonight.
You're very welcome. Very welcome. Anything for Kev?
Thanks, mate. Do appreciate it.
Normally we just have a bit of a 5-minute informal chat. Yep. Just to obviously introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and then we'll kind of have a run through your timeline of employment and business and how you find yourself where you are today.
That's okay. So Gary Holliday, so 44 years old. Grew up in Birmingham, kind of did okay-ish at school. I got 2 GCSEs. I got 1 in dance and 1 in maths.
I've seen you dance. You are a good dancer.
Well, it's an underrated skill, mate, to be honest. I can do a pirouette and I can count how many pirouettes I can do. That's pretty much it. Went to sixth form, wasn't really for me, to be honest. Obviously, I was, like a lot of lads at that age, mid-90s, kind of in football and wanting to get on the beer and stuff like that. So sixth form was never going to work out. Went to go and work for my dad's family business, Holidays Roofing. Quite quickly found out that working up a ladder in Christmas wasn't for me either. So didn't really know what wanted to do. So ended up going to work in a sports shop, and I had one of them kind of back to the future pivotal moments in life, which I guess we'll probably come on to in a sec. And then ended up finding myself working in warehousing, and everything just kind of fell into place and it clicked. Spent then the next 15, 20 years working in various warehouses, various companies. And then again, I had a turn of events in 2020. So a bit before that, 2018, and then decided, look, I'm going to go into business for myself. Took a couple of years to get everything in place and to get rumbling. COVID then got in the way. So we opened our, 1-3 Distribution is the company. We opened our first warehouse in April 2021. And it's gone, there's been some ups and some downs, but on the whole, I think it's gone really well. There was a point last year we was working out of 9 different sites across the Midlands. You know, we've massive companies, Aldi, Tesla, people like that. It's gone really well. This year's by far and away been the toughest that we've had since we started. That's kind of the rapid version, if you look, of where we are today.
I think it's the first year since kind of the post-COVID boom, isn't it, that I think reality's hit in a lot of industries. Construction as well.
It's massive. I mean, LinkedIn is a massive tool for us, and you scroll down LinkedIn in the last kind of 9 to 12 months and it's a horror show. There's warehouse companies that are going bust. There's, far, far more established companies than us. Transport is really, really suffering at the moment. The margins in it are absolutely awful. So it's really, really tough out there at the moment. So yeah, no, I totally agree.
Okay, so if we run it back to, we'll start from the beginning. Check your employment history. Where, to be fair, most of our guests, this started in the 90s.
Yeah.
So for yourself, you began sales system, JJB.
Yeah.
Was that straight out of school?
No, like I said, I went to sixth form for a bit, went to work for our dad's company on the roofs, and like I said, carrying tiles up a ladder in December, that's never going to be for me. And got a job in a sports shop, and I tell the story to my partner's nephews and nieces. I was on £1.80 an hour, and they think this was in like the 1940s and the 1950s. So it was 1996, 1997. But it's comfortably the best, probably the most enjoyable job I ever had. Do you know what I mean? It's a load of young kids working in a sports shop. My first position was on the football shirt wall, if you remember the old JJB in the High Street in Birmingham. So my job in, football nut when I was a kid, it was just unpacking football shirts, putting them on the wall and talking to people when they come in about buying football shirts. And it was brilliant. And then I moved across to footwear, and they made a big thing that I was the youngest head of footwear within JJB, and I'd always been the captain of the football team and all that type of stuff. So I guess it was a natural progression when I started working that I'd end up moving up. But JJB was brilliant. There's some legendary stories about fights kicking off in the basketball court and this shop, and the football court in the shop, and you know, you can imagine the type of things that was going on at the weekends, because it was all young kids just working in the sports shop, and it was brilliant. But there come a point in 1997 where I got into a bit of bother at a works party, at a works event, which kind of was where I said it was like the crossroads. It was the Back to the Future moment. I remember doing years and years later, I was on like a management course, and he used the terminology, that Back to the Future moment. Obviously, if you know the film, there's a certain day in time where the kind of the whole world circles, you know, 1955, whatever it is, and he goes back to that point. He said the majority of people in their working life have that moment, and mine was that. 100%, you know, I've spoke about it hundreds of times over the years. I made a bad decision at a party. I got into a physical altercation, which I shouldn't have done. What happened on the back of that, you know, going to court, potentially, you know, almost going to prison and all that type of stuff, changed everything. And it was on the back of that where I ended up going to work in a warehouse, and then everything changed from that moment. To be fair, things just kind of clicked into place. It kind of, the warehousing was where I was, I think, where I was, unfortunately, it's quite a boring industry to be in. You know, if I could have been a, you know, fighter pilot, or if that was my destiny, it would have been a lot more interesting. But warehousing, because I was a bit of a stats geek when I was a kid with football and stuff like that, warehousing, pick rates, you know, KPIs, stats, all that type of stuff, it just clicked quite early on. And I remember, I think it was my first day working in a warehouse for HMV, and the supervisor come up to me and she handed me the broom, and I went, what's that for? She went, you've got to sweep the floors. I went, so I don't know who you think you're talking to. I'm not sweeping the floors. I did end up sweeping the floors, and it's, yeah, it's been a long story ever since, but it's...
It's that butterfly effect, isn't it? I think what you're referring to as well, that sliding doors butterfly effect, yeah. That if that doesn't happen, you might have ended up in retail for the rest of your life.
100%, and you know, like I said, I genuinely have spoke about it at, you know, at training sessions and management courses, and you know, younger kids that have come into 1-3, younger people that I work with, whether it be HMV or some of the other companies I've been at and stuff. Massive difference. It genuinely, that one decision that I made changed my life, to be fair.
So you started talk there about HMV. Yeah. So that was your first actual position.
First warehouse shop, yeah. I literally, like I said, went in, you know, order picker, sweeping the floors, absolutely everything. And like I said, I hadn't been there long, where they'd bit of a restructure within the warehouse, and there was some promotion opportunities come up, which wasn't even on my radar at the time, but the manager pulled me in and just said, look guys, we really think you should go for this. And I was like, okay, let's have a go. So went for it, got the position, and then kind of over the years kind of steadily moved up. But I mean, working for HMV was brilliant, to be fair. Back in the day, the kind of the company culture was work hard, play harder type of thing. So, you know, and in a warehouse environment, again, similar to the JJB days, a lot of younger people, all of a similar age, similar interests, some unbelievable nights out, some great stories. But the HMV working experience, I had some great bosses at the time. There's a guy called John Higgs that I work with that we had a bit of a fallout years later, and we don't speak anymore, which is unfortunate. But John was probably the best boss I ever had. He was wicked, to be fair. And it was kind of his, you know, his work ethic, his standards. It was that type of stuff that it kind of made me grow up a little bit, to be honest, because you get to a certain, and again, I spoke about this before, you get to a certain age when things kind of click. And it happens for different, you know, different stages for different people. And I get that. Some it happens very young. Some, you know, I know people now that don't know what they want to do, and they're 45. But yeah, John was wicked. Guy called Jamie Ashington, one of the best bits of working advice I ever had. HMV had, we popped up a temporary warehouse in Daventry to do all the campaign processing. You remember HMV, obviously Christmas you get the sales, 2 for 10, all that type of stuff. And just the normal warehouse channels couldn't cope, so we popped up this little warehouse in Daventry. And then when we got there, we realised Daventry had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, so we couldn't get any staff. We had to bus people in from Nottingham, and it was just so hard. And I think I was 19 or 20, completely and utterly out of my depth. I remember sat on the, because they put us all in hotels. I remember literally being sat on the end of my hotel bed at one point, that stressed because of the pressure that I was under. Phoning Jamie, who was my boss at the time, saying, mate, I can't do this anymore. I said, I'm going to have to check. And he genuinely just said, Gaz, look, ride it out, and I promise you will look back in years to come and you'll laugh at it. But what it will teach you when you're doing it will genuinely, it will make you so much stronger the next time you face a bit of a tough work spot. And I put the phone down and I'm thinking, he ain't got a clue what he's talking about. He wants to be here in the thick of it. But I did it, kind of rode it out, and he was 100% true. And I remember I saw him a few years ago, and I was like, mate, you probably don't remember the conversation that you had on the edge of my bed. And like I said, I mean, I was 21. I mean, I wasn't a particularly sensitive 21-year-old. But genuinely, again, as like I said, that, you know, with the sliding doors moment that Kev mentioned, it's, you know, some good bits of advice when you need it. It was massive, to be fair. And he didn't remember the conversation, but he'd stuck with me ever since, to be fair. And then, yeah, HMV was wicked, loved it. You know, we used to get promos of FIFA and all that type of stuff. You know, my nephew never bought FIFA till he was about bloody 13, 14 years old, and it was wicked. And then...
So do you think you've carried that philosophy on? Because every time I come to your warehouse, it's full of energy, and the people you've got working for you are characters, aren't they?
Yeah.
So do you think that you've subconsciously, or is it a conscious thing that you've done now? I mean, fast forwarding a little bit to what you're doing at the moment, yeah. But it's always quite a good atmosphere in your warehouse, and the staff yeah. are banter and on a level.
I mean, the majority of the guys that are with us at 1-3 now, certainly in the Minworth and the Birmingham warehouses, they're all ex-HMV as well. So the guys that I worked with at the time and stuff like that. But warehousing's tough, do you know what I mean? It can get a bit monotonous some days, a bit groundhog day. So having some personalities in there, you know, don't get me wrong, from a managing them point of view, can make it harder at times.
Yeah.
But when you're up against it, you know, when you've got container deliveries and all that type of stuff, having a bit of personality, having that kind of bit of banter about the place, it makes a massive difference, to be fair. But I totally agree. That, you know, having that little bit of energy makes an enormous difference in this warehouse.
You say there, so you were 21 doing what you were doing, just to have an idea of size and scale of what that was, way before Amazon days.
Yeah.
So a lot of this era, this generation, what might not understand the scale of the operation that HMV was then, like you say, the Christmas promotions especially.
It was massive. HMV in its heyday, they had, you know, 240 stores. You know, this was before HMV.com. So this was, you know, very much warehouse, you know, picking CDs, DVDs, you know, even before Blu-ray and VHS, campaign stickers. You know, the Daventry thing was 60,000 square foot. I think we had 140 staff working there. It was 24/7. And there was 21-year-old kid trying to run the show, which was, which was a bit of a challenge, because things fell over. They hadn't done it before. The systems all went pear shaped. Like I said, the agency labour was a challenge. It was really tough. But it was, you know, it was one of them things. At that point, you think this is the hardest work will ever be. I mean, well, it's not. When you move on in your career and different roles and stuff like that, it was. But I look back now. Definitely, it's one of the things that I look back on with quite a lot of pride that I didn't jack. Massive thanks to Jane, if you do ever watch this, mate. Fair play to you. He kind of gave me a bit more belief and just stuck it out.
And then was it a case of, obviously you said you had leadership qualities, that's always been something that's been in your personality. Has that kind of sat behind your long career then? Because how long were you there?
And so I started HMV in 98. I left for the first time in 2012. So I'd progressively moved up. You know, HMV was growing. Obviously, HMV.com had came along at this point. It moved over to Guernsey and then back again. But ultimately, 2011, so my dad passed away. He left. So family-wise, we wasn't in an amazing financial position. And I had a really, really good offer to go to DHL to work for JLR. It genuinely was really tough. You know, it's probably the toughest working decision I've had, because I wasn't leaving HMV for career progression, because ultimately it was a step side, was at best, if anything, it was a step below. But obviously DHL, massive, massive organisation. It was purely a financial decision at the time, because my mother wasn't in a great financial position. So it was kind of supporting the family time more than a work decision. But, you know, even then, getting into DHL, I remember the first day, you know, there was acronym after acronym after acronym, and there was a training guide for the acronyms, and I was like, Jesus Christ. And I remember on my first day, somebody mentioned JLR, and I said, what does JLR stand for? Because I've got myself into such a mindset. And, you know, he just looked at me, he's like, you're running the JLR contract, mate. You might want to know what that means. And then there was another one, it was, you know, the training guide for this, if you, whatever acronyms you don't understand because you're not from automotive, just highlight them all and we'll come and tell you. And I was highlighting all, you know, KPI and this, that and the other. And then there was one of them, it was THE. And the kid coming in training me, he said, THE? He said, in what context? And I showed him, and he went, the. And I just looked at him. I was like, honestly, mate, I've gone blind on the training guys and the acronyms and stuff like that. But, really, really tough. You know, the DHL JLR contract was again, and it's probably what I needed. Having come from the HMV bit, which was quite, you know, quite entrepreneurial, we were still quite raw when you come to things like health and safety and environment and all that type of stuff. And DHL, you just got it absolutely battered into you from the get-go. And the structure of running a warehouse is the bit that I didn't have. So adding that to the HMV bit, is like I said, that's probably when the career started to take off a bit, to be fair. And I remember DHL was, again, quite a tough environment. Again, JLR is quite a demanding customer, but it was the guy that was running the DC at the time, the general plan was he was going to take me under his wing, teach me the automotive, the contracts and all that type of stuff. But then kind of maybe 6 to 9 months in, he made a decision to go and get a position elsewhere with a different business. So I, at that point, had kind of been dangled as the golden boy, and then the guy dangling me weren't there anymore. So that was quite tough. But yeah, rotating shifts. Yeah, just from a lifestyle point of view, it's an experience that I've done. You know, 2 weeks of nights, 2 weeks of lates, 2 weeks of earlies is brutal. I've still got mates now that work for DHL on the same contract or at the car plants, and you know, it's a life choice. Do you know what I mean? The earlies is just a killer. The lates is just a graveyard shift because you've got no life outside of it whatsoever. And as a single lad, you know, having no life outside of work is not healthy. And nights is just, well, it just takes a certain type of animal to work nights, doesn't it? And you either love it or you hate it, but the rotating was tough. And then, yes, was there a few years and literally just completely out of the blue. Got a message from the ops director at HMV at the time who just says, "Gaz, look, things have gone to shit since you've left. What will it take for you to come back?" So I kind of fabricated a salary, said, "This is what I'm earning." It wasn't. And I said, "I'll get this kind of car," and I didn't. And I thought, if he gets anywhere near that, happy days, I'll run back with open arms. And to my surprise, they offered me exactly what I asked for. And I was like, that was Merry Christmas. But that was the tough part of all that. So my old boss, John, who was, like I said, best boss I ever had, I didn't know at the time, but he was being let go in order for me to come back. So when they first made me the offer, I had to sign NDA and, you know, all the non-disclosures and all this type of stuff. And then as it started to get closer, it was made quite apparent that Don was going, which was tough. But yeah, we have had a kind of an ish conversation about it. But you know, I ultimately had to do the best thing for me and the family at the end of the day. And you know, that's part and parcel of work, and it's tough. And you know, again, we'll come onto it in a bit with some of the stuff about Stevie 1-3 this year that's just been brutal. But you know, he is hands down the best boss I've ever had. He was one of my best pals as well at the same time. And the fact that we haven't spoken years over it is tough. But fortunately, that's just how things have panned out. So yeah, ended up going back to HMV in probably 2016, maybe. And life was brilliant. Genuinely was brilliant. You know, we were starting getting into the hospitality at that point. You know, we're going to see Ed Sheeran. And, you know, the HMV conferences were absolutely incredible. They, you know, Ed Sheeran would come and play a few songs at the conference, or James Bay, or, you know, we had Simple Minds played one night. And it was absolutely brilliant. He's, like I said, because the culture very much was everybody works hard, but let's have a great crack when we can. And, you know, compared to some of the other companies I worked for, their management conferences, I remember one that got some German fella coming out talking about the newest scientific technology in PVC, and like everyone, I'm like literally falling off my chair. Yeah, the HMV ones, it was like this is the new, you know, the new Call of Duty that's coming out, the new FIFA that's coming out. And like I said, then when you get someone like Ed Sheeran, they'll come and play a few songs. And because he was such a great, you know, Neil Taylor, who was ultimately running the business at that point, such a top man, and you know, from a leader of business, he absolutely got the culture right with HMV, and it was wicked, to be fair. But then, yeah, I mean, HMV was great, and he was going for a decent spell, obviously, you know, but by this point, the internet had obviously boomed, Amazon had gone absolutely massive, but the supermarkets were walloping HMV at the time. You know, if you was to go into Tesco's and you'd get FIFA for 25 quid, well, HMV were buying it for 30 quid. You know, we actually worked out once that it would be cheaper for HMV. Don't buy the stock from EA, go and buy it from Tesco's off the shelves, and it would be cheaper. And it was ludicrous.
So what is that? That what the buying power was at? Vast.
It wasn't just a combination of buying power. The Tesco's of this world and the Asda's were making a decision that, you know, sell it at a loss.
Cut the threads.
Because you'll wipe HMV out, then they've got nowhere else to go and buy this product other than you. Because if somebody comes in to buy FIFA and buys a loaf of bread, a bottle of milk, a bottle of Pepsi, blah, 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 everything, then that's where they're making it up. But it was tough, for, really, really tough for a spell. And then, obviously, you went through the whole bit of, you know, you went from downloading, then just buying iTunes, whatever, then to streaming, and it just completely crippled everything. You know, you go into a HMV store today, it's nothing like what it used to be. You know, it used to be, 80, 90% CD, DVD? You go in there now, there's a small little section of CD, DVD, and obviously vinyl's making a massive comeback.
I cannot remember the last time I bought into HMV. Mm. Yeah, when we were, HMV was the place to go, wasn't it?
Well, I remember telling my mum in 2016, whenever it was, that I was going back to HMV. She thought I was having a breakdown. She's like, Gaz, HMV doesn't exist anymore because the shop at the fort wasn't there. Do you know what I mean? And it's like that community store that people kind of fund around. And if that one's not there, well, they don't go shopping in town, or they don't go to Coventry or whatever, so they don't know that the other stores were there. But yeah, it was a great, great few years when I went back. I mean, it was different to what it was the first time. It'd been bought out by a company called Hilco, and Hilco were not in it for the love of it. They was in it for the money at the end of the day. So, you know, those things like, you had to get authorisation to order a box of pens and all that type of stuff. It was really, really tightly managed for a bit, but it was brilliant. Great couple of years, loved it. Met my partner, Jules, because she was a HMV as well the second time round. And then, yeah, fast forwarded a couple of years, 2018, we'd had our first daughter, Lena, in November, and HMV was struggling. And then we literally, I think it was Boxing Day, I remember it, me and the missus, we was going down to Hyde Park in London for the Winter Wonderland thing, and I literally get a message come through saying HMV's gone into administration, and we had no pre-warning that it was going to happen. But the general belief was that it would be okay, somebody would buy it. I mean, there was talk of Elton John was going to buy it, Mike Ashley was going to buy it. He dragged on for a bit, and he kind of got to the end of January, I think into early February. And we got told that the company was going to get bought, and that because we had the warehouse where HMV.com was ran from, we'd be okay. And literally woke up one morning to an email that just says, look, the deal's been done last night and the warehousing's not part of it, you're all out of a job. And it was brutal. Like I said, I got a 3-month-old little girl at this point. The missus works for HMV as well. The new owner, is a guy called Doug Putman from the States, up in Canada. Really, really wealthy guy who had bought out HMV in Canada when that went into difficulty. So I got offered. So Neil, who was the ops director at HMV at the time, asked me if I wanted to come down to London to meet the new owner. I was fully prepared to go down there and kick off. Quite angry, you know, obviously, again, everything was going on at home, and frustratingly, he was a really, really nice fella, to be honest, and they offered me a position to stay, but it was only me, not everybody that I worked with, and I just says, mate, look, you know, really, really appreciate the offer, but if you think I'm going to walk back into that warehouse and wave everybody off and I'm staying, I said, there's absolutely no way I'm going to be able to do that, and I wanted to go full on Jerry Maguire, you know, get the goldfish, leaving and blah, 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 but I didn't because he was such a nice fella, and it was quite difficult to do. And then literally walked out of that office, said a few goodbyes, sat on the train, and I just said, I'm gonna go on my own. I'm gonna start my own business. And I remember phoning Jules up at the time saying, look, they've offered me a job. And she's just like, oh, thank God, the pressure that takes off. I said, yeah, but I've told them no. I won't repeat the word she used, but it wasn't very nice. And the fact, I'm amazed that we're still together after the way she spoke to me that day, to be honest. But I wrote a very, very rough business plan. And I got no experience in doing that type of thing, but I had an idea. I had a thought that, because I'd been at DHL and I'd saw the way that 3PLs worked, I thought I could do it better. And broke the business plan on the train on the way back, but still didn't have a job. So LinkedIn was brilliant at that time, so I got out of a load of recruiters. CV was updated and flying out apps everywhere. But I remember saying to Joel, I said, look, I know what I'm doing. When I left HMV to go to DHL, with the greatest of respect, I didn't come across that many great people. And I had a massive belief that I was going to be okay. I didn't think I was going to be unemployed for long. And I got about 8 or 9 job offers. And made one of the biggest mistakes. Again, I mean, I do believe that everything happens for a reason. So the job offers that I had, I got it down to two. One was Unipart, So the guy that I was with at DHL, a guy called Ash Evans, the guy that took me under his wing for 6 months before he left, he was at Unipar and he went to bat for me quite a lot. So he got Unipar to raise the offer of what a standard GM would get. And he got them to really go to town and kind of increase the offer. And then the other company was a company called the Epwin Group over in Telford. So they do windows and doors and all that type of stuff. But I'd never been in the building industry. So there was parts of that that was quite appealing. But Unipar was global. You know, Ash, I'd spoke to Ash over the years and, you know, he said, you know, I've got a position I think you'd be brilliant for, but it's in Chicago. And, you know, there's loads of opportunities like that. But I went where the money was, to be honest, and Epwin offered quite a lot more. I remember even, so I wanted to go, I genuinely wanted the Unipar role more because it was more attractive, more, you know, more opportunities and that type of stuff. And I even remember I was at Crufts and I was walking around Crufts when the phone call come through. So Epwin had offered me, So Epwin had offered me 70s, say. Unipar initially was only around about the 55 mark. So I'd said to Unipar, look, this is the situation. I've got a 5-month-old little girl at this point. I can't afford to walk away from 15 grand a year. So Unipar basically said, look, we'll match that offer if you come to us. And I was like, brilliant, I'm going to go. So I phoned Epwin back. And I genuinely wasn't trying to play him off against each other. I know how he looks. And I know how Ash feels about it as well, because he hasn't spoke to me either. I basically said to Epwin, I said, look, really sorry. Unipar have offered me 90. The reason I said it was to kind of say, because I thought, there's no way you're going to match that. But I just thought, right, it'll just end the conversation. And to my surprise, she turned around and said, well, if we match 90, will you come to us? And I just thought, you're joking. I thought this is almost double the salary that I was on at HMB. And I said, yeah. I said, if you match that, I said, the conversation's over now. I said, no, I'll sign on the dotted line. And so she phoned me back 5 minutes later when I was checking out the Springer Spaniels or whatever it was at Crufts. And yeah, they made the offer. And I just put the phone down. And Jules was next to me. I just genuinely can't believe that that's what I'm going to be earning for a living. Phoned Unipar and I just said, look, this genuinely isn't me trying to play you off now, but the conversation has to end. Excuse me. And Ash took it quite personal, which is, again, disappointing, because Ash was brilliant for me at DHL. And, you know, anybody that's ever worked with him at, you know, at Land Rover or at, you know, General Motors or Unipar or whatever, top man, really top man. And like I said, he took it personally, and it wasn't personal. I was just a 32-year-old, whatever I was at this point, 28, 30-year-old, with a 3-4-month-old baby and a missus, because she was at HMB as well. She'd been made redundant, but she's on paternity leave. So literally I had to earn whatever we needed to earn for the salary. And ultimately, like I said, it's probably the first, well, no, it's the second time, because I did it when I went to DHL, a decision purely based on finance. And it didn't work out at all, to be fair. I went to Epwin. It wasn't for me.
Is this where you are? Is this where you encountered the conference regarding the PVs?
Yeah, tough. You ever read Wayne Rooney's book? So if we read Wayne Rooney's book, he talks about, you know, why he is the way he is, and, you know, it's because he loves it. If I don't love what I do, I'm nowhere near as effective, and that's ultimately what I found at Epwin. It wasn't for me. The product is not something that gets more, you know, juices flowing. There was people that had been there way, you know, it's a really established team of people that was there, and the new guy coming in, was just tough. And it was, like I said, it was never going to be a long-term thing for me, because I'd already got in the back of my head the business plan for 1-3. I knew what I wanted to do long-term. The Epwin was a means to an end from a salary point of view because of the position I was in. But it was an industry that I'd never worked in. So I was like, right, it'll tick another box. But yeah, it was tough. I think I was there, 18 months, 2 years. And then I was there or thereabouts ready for 1-3. But I thought, I just want to dip my toe back into the 3PL world, just to kind of get re-familiar with, you know, rates, contracts, all that type of stuff. And a job came across my desk for Clipper Logistics, and it was the Halfords contract, so managing Halfords. So again, as you can tell from the physique, I'm not exactly the keep fit freak. I don't have a mountain bike or anything like that, but it was a lot more appealing than what the job was at Epwin. It was a pay cut, so I think I took 20-ish grand a year pay cut to go there. But it was, it's like I said, I had a, you know, I had a clear route to what I was doing, and that position fit quite well. Clipper was a mistake completely. Face didn't fit, didn't get on with my boss from day one. He had views of how a warehouse should be run, and I just fundamentally didn't agree. So it kind of, it really, really sped up my, the 1-3 project. It made me just think, oh, I can't stick this guy whatsoever, because he's going to, if I don't get out, he's going to sack me anyway. And like I said, it was nothing to do with ability. I mean, I've run absolutely monstrous warehouses. It was nothing to do with that. It was nothing to do with, you know, capability within the role, but just didn't fit. And it's probably the first, it's the first time I've ever had that in my working life where you just clash with your boss. Yep. And, you know, I see it all the time on LinkedIn, you know, don't pick a job, pick a boss. And it's completely and utterly true. Because like I said, you know, you look at John and you look at Ash, you know, these are really, really experienced guys that knew that I knew that what I was doing. This guy, we just had a complete difference of opinion, and the and I was saved by COVID, to be fair. So COVID at this point was just starting to come along, and I got a phone call from a guy that I used to work with at HMV called Fraser Padgett, and he just said, "Gaz, look, we've got this job opening up. It's on the COVID project." I was like, "There's a project?" I didn't even know what was going on. He said, "I think you'd be brilliant for it. Are you interested? It's a contractor job, but we need you to start on Monday." I was like, "Oh." So at this point, I'm still in my 6-month probation with Clipper, and tried to phone the boss, couldn't get hold of him, left him a couple of messages, didn't get a reply. This was the Thursday. Then on the Friday, I'm like, "Well, I've got to make a decision here, because the offer with the COVID thing is that, you know, it's a decent day rate as a contractor, but ultimately I've never walked out on a job in my life. I think it's disgusting, to be honest, the way to do it, but it was a two-way street. There was no respect given, so there was no respect shown back. You finally phone me, I think it was about 3:30 on the Friday afternoon, and I'd already packed up my desk and my office, and I just says, "Mate, I'm off." And he just says, "When?" I went, "I'm literally walking out the door now, mate. I start my new job on Monday." I said, "This isn't for me." And we had a bit of a barney down the phone, but, you know, Clipper's a massive, massive company, and, you know, they've obviously had the buyout a couple of years ago, and, you know, they've got some enormous contracts in the 3PL world, you know, Halfords and Zara and people like that. It just wasn't for me. And then moving into the COVID job, so it was the, like I said, it was starting to take a bit of a foothold within the UK. So they set up a control tower in Birmingham. So it was on the Birmingham Business Park, right where all the roadworks were. It was an absolutely wonderful park. and it was like, "Okay, so Gaz, right, you're in charge, you're running the show. We need you to recruit 60 people, and we need them to start Monday." And it was tough, because it's, again, there's no training manual for it. There's no precedent, because nobody knows what you're doing, because nobody knows what the virus is doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was literally, you know, rapid get people in, you know, but we had a mixture of people that weren't in employment. We had a mixture of people that were in employment, that quit jobs to come and do this. A real, real good friend of mine, Dane Rogers, you may know Dane, don't you? So Dane, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, but Dane came and worked with us. And I was telling somebody the other day, the interview process for Dane. So Dane, if you don't know him, he'd been in the forces, special forces, and he's done the type of Andy McNab stuff and all that type of thing. And got him in for an interview, and I said to the HR girl, I said, "Look, I know this guy." I said, "So you lead the interview and I'll just sit back." And she asked him, "What's the most stressful working environment he's ever been in?" And he looked at me as if to say, she's got no idea where I've come from, has she? And he proceeded to tell this story about, I think it was Afghanistan or somewhere, where he's taking fire. One of his best mates has been shot, and Dane's had to pull him out of the gunfight. And, you know, he's trying to phone in an airstrike and all this stuff. Like, it's proper Call of Duty type stuff. But you could tell just by looking at him, he was 100% like the truth. And I genuinely never forget, at the end of the interview, he winked at the girl and he went, "Was that stressful enough for you?" And honestly, it was the best interview response I've ever seen in my life. And the girl said to me afterwards, "Well, I think you'll be okay answering the phones in the control tower." I said, "Do you think so?" And he was brilliant. He came in, he did such a good job. And it's such a shame he's not with us anymore, but he was such a top lad. And but yeah, COVID was really tough. And then obviously, again, if you don't know the ins and outs of COVID, obviously there was two types of tests. There was the PCR test, which was the original one, which would take a few days to get your results. And then there was the lateral flow, which was the instant rapid response test. So done the control tower for about 3 or 4 months. So Fraser had moved on to a separate department. My boss was a guy called Mike Hegarty, again, top man, really real, you know, from a leadership point of view, in the absolute toughest working environment I've ever been in, Mike was phenomenal. I mean, I think he'd come from Bentley and places like that, and, you know, I'll still see him dotting about on LinkedIn every now and then and stuff like that, but Mike's phenomenal. And so he came to me and offered me a promotion sideways step to basically to head up the natural flow part of COVID. So it was the prisons, the care homes, the schools, all that type of stuff. And, you know, it was literally some days were 24, 25 hour days. Do you know what I mean? And you're sat in front of your laptop and it's meeting to meeting to meeting. It's strategy, it's logistics. It's I remember getting a phone call on a Saturday afternoon because a delivery driver has crashed into the Recom Arena with a truck full of COVID tests. And when they pulled the driver out, he's drunk. And I'm just like, so I'm trying to sort that while we're trying to sort out the strategy and all the other stuff. So it's such a varied job. But some of the people that was on that COVID program, I know that the general public slammed the COVID response, but some of the people that they had working were some of the absolute very best people that the country's got. They're absolutely phenomenal. Don't get me wrong, there were some chances on there that must have thanked their lucky stars that they found themselves in them jobs and them day rates. But some of the people there, it was incredible, you know, genuinely the best in their fields and stuff like that. And that's one of the other pivotal things I've got in my career, which is I'm in 1-3 now. It's the people that opened you up to and the contacts and all that type of thing. But it was so unbelievably tough. You know, you literally, like I said, 78 hours a week, and you'd get through to Friday. You're absolutely on your knees. I haven't seen the missus and the kids all week. And you're having your dinner, and Boris Johnson and Hancock's on the TV, and they're completely contradicting everything that you've spent all week working. Well, back to the drawing board on Monday, but brilliant opportunity to work with Fraser and Mike and some of the other guys. And then, but as COVID was kind of coming towards the end, you know, the was kind of winning, I said, right, it's now or never now with 1-3. So we had a warehouse identified. I'd had the finance, a bit of backing from a good man, Steve Harris. I'd had a few people that knew that what I was trying to do that said, look, yeah, I'll back you with the money and stuff like that. But Steve was just a really good fit. You know, I've known him since I was probably about 5 or 6. He just said, look, you know, it's not my bag, it's not my game, but I get that you're really good at it. So, he wasn't like an investor where he's standing on your shoulder, I want my money back and all this type of thing. He genuinely allowed me to start it up, make a few mistakes, as everybody does when they're starting a business. And we got the first warehouse open in Chantry in Minworth on my birthday on April 12th, 2021. And Kev's been there a few times. It's a lovely, lovely little place. But the first 3.5-4 months were absolutely savage. Couldn't get a contract. And I genuinely thought that with the contacts that I had, it would be easier. It wasn't, because I couldn't lose count of the amount of times I had people turn around and say, Gaz, yeah, we get that you're brilliant at running a warehouse, but you're completely untested as far as running a business goes. And
so that's how you went at it. You knew that you could do it.
I knew
there was no kind of promise of anything at that point.
There was a couple of, you know, before we actually took the lease on the warehouse, you know, I was kind of obviously engaging with different companies about trying to take on the warehouse in. Because I was thinking, right, I can't take on a warehouse and pay 50 grand deposit at the bank without having a contract. But the knock-on effect was people weren't going to give me the contract unless I had the warehouse to go and show them. So in the end, we just had to bite the bullet and we took the warehouse on. 50, 60 grand deposit, I think what it was. And had to pay then the first quarter's rent up front and all that type of stuff. And luckily, Steve, he's similar game to you, he's in the electric game. So the place needed a lighting upgrade and all that. So Steve coming in did all of that. Sent us an invoice for it, which I wasn't expecting. I thought it was out for cost, but he sent us the invoice for it. And we then got a couple of contracts, but they wasn't enough. And then there was one day, it was the same day, and I think it was October something, and we signed a massive contract with Aldi and a massive contract with H&V on the same day, and everything just took off from there. Then and headcount went up. We had to take on another site in Warsaw. Then we took on a site in Northampton. And it was brilliant, but the business learning from it was, the amount of money that was coming through that first 12 months allowed me to make mistakes. Do you know, I've done the stupid stuff that every, I imagine most new business owners do that first 12 months when the money starts rolling through, and you know, you're taking the lads out here and there and you're getting a box at the Blues and all the other type of stuff that you do with it, which is great. And it's great that, you know, you can do that and you can help out your family and your friends and all that type of stuff. But it's not running a business, is it, to be fair? But like I said, we just had, there was that much coming through. It allowed me to make some quite stupid schoolboy errors, to be fair. Because like I said, I'd run warehouses, you know, 500,000 square foot warehouses for DHL. It was obviously the COVID job, you know, such a massive high position of responsibility. But running a business is completely different. You know, I'd run massive multi-million pound P&Ls, but it's just different when you draw a name on the bank account, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, that's it. How do you find, obviously, from being in a position of authority and having the responsibility you've had your entire life, then to be the person, the proprietor, the company secretary, the employer?
Tough. I mean, that first 12 months, I was the sales guy, the finance guy, the health and safety guy, the HR guy, the ops guy. You're everything. You know, you're the shoulder to cry on. You're the guy that's got to give him a kick up the arse. You're absolutely everything. And it's like I said, because I was probably quite, I think I was quite well prepared for it from the HMV days, because, you know, the warehouse manager at HMV, the company is such a retail store-based business. The warehouses are kind of left on their own a little bit. So you are doing HR, IT, blah, 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 a bit of finance, all that type of stuff. So it was quite well-rounded. But it's the pressure that it doesn't prepare you for. And, you know, there was a couple of times that first 6-9 months where, don't get me wrong, our payroll at this point was peanuts in the scheme of things. But I had to pay it myself. Now, Jules doesn't know this. So if Jules does ever watch this, that will come as a bit of a shock to her, because I remember, I think I had to pay about 16, 17 grand on payroll because we hadn't been paid. And, you know, we've had a few, you know, over the years where, you know, a few customers are a little bit difficult to get payment out of. And it's, there's a lot of benefits to working with a small company, but pay them. Because if you don't, the pressure that it puts on, you know, I get it all the time. It's part of the reason why I come off Facebook, to be honest, because, you know, I get loads of, oh, guys, you know, it must be brilliant. You know, you've got all the money in the world. You know, you go to the World Cup in Qatar and the Grand National and all this and the other. And I don't believe everything you see. Do you know what I mean? Because you don't see the 3 o'clock in the morning where you're lying there looking at the ceiling thinking, if so-and-so doesn't pay me tomorrow, we're fucked. You know, and the missus is asleep next to you and you don't want to tell her how much pressure you're under because she's got the little one. And, you know, I mean, my whole approach to, you know, the relationship with Jules is that if the home life, I can deal with whatever work throws at me as long as the home life's okay. If the home life wobbles, I can't handle everything. So that's, you know, and I don't know whether it's a good thing or whether it's a bad thing, but, you know, trying to keep the missus in the dark a little bit so she doesn't understand the pressure you're under. But it's carnage, man. It's really, really tough. And, you know, there's a guy called Simon Bourne on LinkedIn, the shoe guy, he calls himself. And he brought out a book because he had his own business, but he effectively had to declare himself bankrupt. And his book is brilliant. And he tells you about the pressures that he was under because he had a young family and stuff like that as well. But it's tough. And honestly, the amount of times I get now, people come up to me and say, I've got a great business idea and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, okay, do you just need money? Because if you need money, that's a different thing. Because if that's all you think you need, you ain't got a clue what it's actually like running a business. And, you know, there's a side hustle and then there's a business. But running a business is absolutely, it's so hard.
Yeah, just kind of, like you say there, with the family life, it's kind of counterintuitive to what a relationship is meant to be, isn't it? Yeah. You're meant to be able to go home, talk about everything together. Yeah. You ask your wife or your partner, you know, they share everything with you. But like you say, as a business owner, that's not a conversation you really have, is it?
It's, and genuinely, this year has been the worst by a mile. We had another little girl in September. I mean, Kev knows what's going on. I said Christmas, she was in Birmingham Children's Hospital all over Christmas with measles. So she actually went into cardiac arrest while we was in there. And so, long story short, basically my partner also got measles. A 5-year-old got measles, so they couldn't come and sit with her. So I was there from December the 24th, I think it was, till about January the 3rd. So I spent all the Christmas Day, Boxing Day, New Year's Eve in the Birmingham Children's Hospital. And then when you come out of that, it just, I won't say change perspective on life, because, you know, family is obviously priority number one. But you've got to keep the business running, because if you haven't got that, I mean, 90% of the people that I know live month to month. I don't want to live month to month. I mean, I worked my arse off for 30 years to not live month to month. But I just kind of come out of Christmas and I was just in a complete fog. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't get me back into work or anything. And in my game, January is massive, because you get loads of people come out of Christmas and they're like, you know, our warehouse haven't performed and we're going to look for a new 3PL and all that type of stuff. January was just a write-off. It was a complete blur. Head wasn't in it whatsoever. And we then rolled into another shit show in kind of mid-February. One of our biggest customers went bump, owing us the best part of 200 grand. So to go from the Christmas with the little end to a massive bust up with Jules and all that type of stuff in January, to then go into that, obviously, like I said, didn't pick up on that and capitalise on the new business that was about in January, to then going into that, it was just genuinely, I remember saying to Kev, at one point, I feel like fucking Jeremy Beadle's going to jump out with the camera and just say, "Tell me, I told me to wind up, mate, push the reset button, go back to Christmas and start again." But it's just...
Do you find that in cycles? Because I've noticed that myself. Do you find sometimes it feels like a comedy of scenarios when one thing happens, another thing, another thing to get... Sometimes you're reading your emails, you go, "Oh, come on."
Yeah. I mean, the first kind of 12, 18 months of 1-3, and again, I've spoken about it a couple of times, it was as if everything that could have gone either way, 50-50, everything went our way. You know, winning that contract with Aldi shouldn't have touched us with the barge pole. I mean, we were such a small company. But we got Aldi, we got HMV, we got some others, you know, we got a deal with Tesla and stuff like that. It was the first kind of spell where it was just like everything went against us. And, you know, I genuinely, you know, I've seen the memes when, you know, it's about guys that sit on the end of the bed. You know, I've gone driving home from work and I've just gone and parked around the fucking corner and sat there for about half an hour. I feel like I'm just going to do something stupid. But the pressure was just, you can't explain it to somebody. I mean, there's a real good business that I work with. You might want to have a chat with her about getting on here, to be fair. A girl called Danny Wykes that runs LSG. So it's the Logistics Solutions Group. Phenomenal single parent, works her absolute arse off to provide the absolute best for her kids and stuff. But again, the pressure that she finds herself under, you can't, I mean, you'll be the same. You can't explain it to people that are not in it, because it's all encompassing, doesn't it? You know, you can't sleep, you don't want to eat. If you go out on the weekends, you don't just find yourself going out with a few beers, you go out and have an absolute blowout, which then, oh, it's tough, man. Tough, tough, tough. Like I said, I'm not a particularly sensitive fella, and I've, you know, obviously, you know, managing people over the years, mental health has become much more of a thing than it ever was. But when you're the guy running the company, and like I said, you have to be quite a lean management team, because you can't afford all the bells and whistles. There genuinely is nobody to talk to. Like you said, Chris, you can't go home and unload all of that on the missus, because you just don't want to add, you know, woes and stress and hassle to that part of your life. Because at the moment, if that part of your life is quite stable and quite solid, and, you know, being able to go home and, you know, and have a chill and, you know, play with the kids and all that type of stuff, that is the balance to the bad day. I literally have a handful of mates that have got their own businesses, but even them, they're not operating at the same, you know, the same turnover that 1-3 operates at, which, you know, again, obviously the more money comes in, the more money goes out type of thing at the end of the day. And there genuinely isn't that many people that you can talk to, and it's really, really tough. And, you know, you the epitome of the meme, and you don't go down the pub and talk to your mates about it, you just don't. But like I said, genuinely, I can, hundreds of times I've drove home from work and parked up on the side of the road before I've gone home, because you've just got to blow the day off before you get in.
Yeah.
And I haven't mastered that at all.
No.
And
I don't think many people have. I think that is literally, and you find yourself then at home and you find that spilling over in the house, and it makes you less of a dad, doesn't it, and less of a partner. And
I've been vile this year, and, you know, obviously what happened at Christmas with Little certainly didn't help, but the pressure of the business, that company going bust, you know, I had to lay off one of our managers last year, and it was purely a performance thing. But I've known the guy since I was 10, and you know, it still sits with me now, and he, you know, his missus has given me a load of shit online and stuff like that, and it's just... It doesn't matter how many times you say it to yourself, it's not personal, but it is to him. And, you know, that even that company this year that went bust on us, we had to close a warehouse down. We had to lay off, I think it was about 5 or 6 people. Two of them are two of my best mates. You know, I was in Gulf in Morocco with them both in January because on the back of what happened with the Christmas, I just needed to get away for a bit. So we'd be my two best pals, or two of my best pals, to go and play golf in Morocco. Yet 8-9 weeks later, the business is absolutely really on its arse and had to lay them both off. And one of them hasn't spoke to me since. And it's just, it's like I said, it's all in little bits that just think people have got no idea what the reality is.
You're like, it's not personal, but if we don't, we can't afford to.
Okay, but when HMV made me redundant, I was massively angry, and I'm his pal. So I get it. I get why he's angry, but
that's gone a lot where the line, isn't it, blurs, and it's quite difficult with friends,
employing your friends,
colleagues, or even difficult. Yeah.
One of the biggest learnings I've had, and it's, but you know, when you're a new business and you're starting off, you know, you don't have the time to go through a lengthy recruitment process. So you recruit people that you've worked with.
Better the devil you know, isn't it?
Yeah, but obviously then the problem that then comes is when the company hits hard times, and it really, you know, this company going bust on us genuinely could have put us under. And it's only by, you know, a bit of juggling. We've also got some really, really good companies that we work with. So the company that does a lot of our pallet movements, you know, I just said, mate, look, I'm in the brown stuff a bit here. He, you know, kind of extended our payment terms, and, you know, he was really flexible with me, you know, the invoicing, all that type of stuff. But like I said, all
that the warehouse as well.
Yeah.
Sorted you out in there.
Yeah. But it all, literally, but like I said, when you're an employee, if, all right, you care, but you don't care the way that you care now. And it's like I said, all of it just comes down on you. You can't then share all of that with the management team, because they'll be bricking and thinking, Jesus Christ, if the company's really struggling and I might be out of a job, you can't go home and tell the missus, because you really don't want that. And, yeah,
so you've got it all as a red then, just like...
Yeah, massively. But like I said, I totally know that I've been involved this year. And it's only really now, probably the last 3-4 weeks, where I can see that we are going to be okay and that we are going to get through it, that things have started to line up a little bit. But it's been horrible. Horrible six, 7 months.
Let's talk about VIP Volcano. Let's lighten it up. Is it... apparently the rumour mill is saying that It's about to re-erupt. Is that a word?
So yeah. What is
VIP was good.
So what is VIP Volcano?
So VIP Volcano. So go back a few years. One of our best pals, Wayne McNamara, unfortunately got motor neuron disease. We, as a group of his pals, we kicked in some fundraising for him and his family. We did quite well. I think it was $50,000-ish that we raised for him.
Just jumping in, your whole bike riding. That helped, didn't it?
When
you were doing your bike ride.
Massively. We did a charity bike ride, we did charity football, but a lot of the fundraising come from basically an online auction thing that we did on Facebook. And it worked really well, and it kind of triggered the thing in the back of my head that there could be something in that as a business down the line. And, you know, the general premise of VI Volcano was... you know, obviously on the back of COVID, a lot of these competition websites started to pop up, you know, where you can win a washing machine or a computer or a, you know, a yacht or whatever. But there was nobody doing it for kind of VIP tickets and events. We now know why. But the general belief was, you know, again, I go and see Ed Sheeran, the tickets might be 500, 600, 700 quid, whatever it may be, for the top VIP, food, drinks, hospitality, the lot. There's only a certain percentage of the population that can afford to pay that. But everybody would love to do it. So the premise was everybody gets to be a VIP. So we would sell tickets to a competition on the website. We would then do a live show every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever night it was. Me and a comedy genius called Brendan McVeigh that would do the live shows. Obviously, Kev did all the technical bit, all the clever bit. And we genuinely thought it would do okay. We partnered up with the Motor Neuron Disease Association. So we had the charity element to it as well. And obviously, you know, on the back of Wayne, but also obviously Rob Burrow and Kev Sinfield. And, you know, Motor Neuron is probably one of the most popular is probably the wrong word, one of the most popular, well-known charities that's out there at the moment. And we genuinely thought, we thought it was going to do okay. It obviously didn't.
From a business point of view? What was the problem with that?
The two things that I learned. I genuinely think that I thought just putting two VIP tickets to Taylor Swift on Facebook was going to be enough. That he would just naturally just spawn into this monster. I think in hindsight, going into business with your pals because they're your pals is a terrible idea. We quite quickly found out that, because Kevin, you weren't even in it from the beginning.
No.
We quickly found out that the skill set that we had as a group of lads was not what we needed. Like I said, I'm a little bit of an all-rounder, but you know, we had lads that work on the rail, we have lads that paint and decorators, and you know, it was just, we was in business because there was our pals, and we just, there was a lot of them that just couldn't bring anything to the table, really. And we probably lost 100 grand, probably, all in, with the cost of the website, some of the tickets that we did. You know, again, we openly talked about it, didn't we? We went too big too quick.
Yeah, we ran before we could walk a little bit. We had all these amazing prizes, but only limited eyes on them. And again, we didn't really, when I came in, there wasn't a business plan. There wasn't anything to say.
We was massively naive to think that, you know, we just put, you know, because I've got 2,000 connections on Facebook, he's got 2,000, blah, 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 blah. We put two VIP tickets to the FA Cup final, £2 a ticket. We just naturally thought we're going to sell 10,000 of these. What we underestimated was people thinking that you're a scam.
Yeah.
That was probably priority number one. The marketing thing, we didn't set aside any money for marketing or advertising whatsoever.
We thought it was going to go,
organically. Just sort of be more organic and just explode and go viral. And, you know, we talked about it quite a lot, that all it will take is one competition to go viral and we'll crack it.
The irony of it was we broke even on the last two competitions, didn't we, for the Ed Sheeran in Vegas and for the Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
But it already had been money.
It's like I said, you know,
there's too much money spent by then.
Yeah, and, I remember, you know, before we even started 1-3, reading something that, is it like 98% of businesses don't last 12 months or something like that? It was such a shame because I still think now, I genuinely do think that, you know, the way to raise money is you don't get one person to put £1,000 in, you get 1,000 people to put £1 in. And there's still nobody online doing what we were doing.
On the plus side, some of the things that people won, unbelievable. And that, even that video of that bloke who won it and his daughter was dancing around, I think.
The Taylor Swift one, wasn't it?
Taylor Swift at the end.
And it's like that, you know. And we did obviously the big wheel and stuff like that, and it was totally random. And
people commenting and coming on the Thursday nights. It was
and then you get videos of it, you know, we said, you know, the little girl that won the Taylor Swift tickets absolutely burst into tears. And it's, you know, it's that type of stuff. We've given people some unbelievable nights out and some unbelievable memories. It's just not business.
I think we find that the problem is the people giving away washing machines and cars and whatever they give away is that gets sent to these. Yeah. People have got to make the effort to go to these, which just coming out of COVID as well.
Mm. Yeah.
It was
everything. You know, straight away. Italy, wasn't there?
We're doing Taylor Swift, but it's not till next year and stuff like that. And it's everybody wants
instant gratification.
Yeah. Mm. You know, we did some of the ninja barbecues and some of the physical items that did really, really well, didn't they? Some of the kids' stuff that we did, Peppa Pig World and stuff like that, they did really, really well. But the problem was there was 70-80% of all tickets purchased were people that we knew.
Mm.
And we always knew that from a point.
That would be a great start off, but we expected it then.
You just didn't click, did it? It was such a shame as well because, as I said, you know, the charity bit, you know,
10% of it was all going to charity on it.
Yeah. Such a shame, but ultimately the money that we put in, we just couldn't justify keeping it going in. Mm. And fair. And it's a learning. Like I said, I fundamentally still think as a business that would work, could work. We just had the wrong team of people. We didn't understand marketing. We went too hard, too fast. And, you know, we really, really went heavy on them prizes to begin with. I mean, probably spent 20, 30 grand on, you know, VIP tickets to Madonna, and we sold no tickets. You know, we went FA Cup final, probably about 1,500 quid each. Didn't get anywhere near. And it's, because we had a following of 10 people, and that was it. But it was such a good, you know, it was, again, you know, learning, you know, don't get me wrong, if I could turn the clock back, would we have done it? Probably not, because I'd have had 100 grand in the bank.
But then it would have been different when you'd have got me on board quicker.
Well, but we, you know, me, you and Brett have spoke about it when we relaunched it and stuff like that. Again, it's, I don't know. But great, great few months, good crack. And again, you know, we're fortunate that we, you know, there was a few of us within the group that was in a position where, don't get me wrong, I'm not arrogant enough to say that we could blow off 50 grand, 100 grand, because we couldn't. But we had the money to have a go at it. It just didn't work out.
Mm. So what are your plans for the future? What's the plans of...
Exciting stuff, mate. I am about to be confirmed, maybe today, as chairman of Ashby Ivanhoe FC. So they're a Step 5 club over in Ashby de la Zouche. So we, as you know, we when I was a kid, I didn't want to be a pro footballer. I wanted to own the football club. It was just that I was wired when I was a kid. We nearly bought Nuneaton Borough last year. A multitude of reasons why that didn't work out. We've had a chat with a couple of other clubs this year, but it looks like Ashby's going through today. Little club in Ashby de la Zouche, family run, got 50 odd youth teams. Last season was the highest league position that they've ever had. It's tough at that level because you sometimes get moved sideways geographically. But we had some real good meetings with the first team, manager, the head of youth, the directors and stuff like that. So quite excited about that because it's what I've always wanted to do. I've got a few other business interests at the moment. So obviously we're in the wonderful Solihull Moors today. So I have a share of a football club in Gibraltar, the Gibraltar Lions, which hopefully this season is going to be phenomenal, hopefully getting to the Champions League. A few other companies, one that we invested in this week, which I'm really excited about, so there's a guy called Casey Alexander. If you don't know him, go and find him on LinkedIn because he's a really, really inspirational fella. His company's called The Suit Group. Really, really high quality, you know, tailored suits at prices that everybody can afford, to be fair. But he's more than that. He's just, you know, sometimes you don't just invest in the business, you invest in the people. And Casey's one of them who's going to get to the top. In something, it might not be the Super Group, but he'll get there in something because that's just how he's wired. But the Ashby thing, I mean, to answer your question, from a commercial point of view, there isn't one. So the club is sustainable to a point. You know, they've got a club, they own the land, which is a massive thing in non-league football. So, you know, some of the clubs around here, they're paying quite chunky rents to go and play. Ashby own it. They've got a clubhouse, they've got a bar, they've got a catering facility on site, they've got 50 plus kids teams. It's a really, really well-run club. They just need, I don't know if that's going to come across them, but they probably need a bit of leadership at the top to pull everything together. A bit more energy than what they've got, and some fresh pair of eyes, I think, and some fresh thinking and stuff. And, you know, some of the ideas we had at Nuneaton were, I think, brilliant. We're going to move them across to Ashby, and I think we'll do really well.
From a business part of view, you're not going to...
It's not a business thing. This one is... It's
passion.
It's exactly that. And it's, you know, we talked about having that, you know, if you haven't got anything away from your business, I think you'll go insane. And obviously we play golf. I'm not particularly good at it, but we love playing golf. It's a bit of a, you know, stress release. But it's to have something that will get more juices flowing, that will occupy my brain, that isn't in a warehouse. And I've always wanted to do it. Like I said, when I was a kid playing Swiss football, my dad used to run the team and all that type of stuff, and that's probably where it comes from. Never thought I'd get the opportunity at that level. Like I said, we're in the FA Cup every year, and you know, it was at Wembley on Saturday watching the Moors, and you know, the game before, Ashby are in that competition. I think they got to the quarterfinals a couple of years ago. So, you know, the thought that I could be running a team that gets to Wembley, I mean, I don't need to make money out of that. I don't want to lose any money doing it. But if we can do it in a way that, you know, we run it the right way, and, you know, the kids' teams are all run in a particular way that's right and that they're all looked after, and, you know, we've got that pathway that gets through to the men's team. And I've got two little girls at home. You know, obviously women's football's massive at the moment, and these guys appreciate that and understand it. And my understanding is the girl that runs the ladies' teams is really good. I haven't quite met with her yet, but you know, it's all that type of thing. It's not about money for me, the football bit. It's probably a bit of ego in there somewhere. But it's more just to have something just to occupy my brain, to be fair, that does some good.
Yeah, I was going to say, you should essentially become a pillar of the community, won't you? You become.
I think so. I have had a look to see if there are any warehouses for rent over in Ashbury, but there isn't any. I mean, it's a really, really, you know, it's quite a, you know, a nice area as well. You know, some of the houses when you're driving in are, well, fit my house in your garage type of thing, but it's a massive opportunity over there. You know, the club itself, there's not a great deal of competition about it, but I don't think they've got the level of backing from the local businesses and the community that I think they could, and that will be the plan, that we try and get everybody involved. And, you know, I was talking to him the other day about, you know, what you're trying to create now with a football club is, you know, to try and get young people to come and watch and pay a tenner to come and watch, you're not up against the football club down the road. You're up against the cinema. I mean, you're up against bowling. You're up against sat on your ass 3 hours listening to, you know, watching Netflix or whatever. It can't just be a game of football. It's got to be something that people want to come and spend 3 hours of their Saturday and 10, 15, 20 quid. You know, you want them to come and have a couple of beers, buy a burger, you know, have a bit of a crack and that type of stuff. So, you know, it's trying to create...
an engagement, isn't it?
100%. But, you know, but again, you know, some of the, you know, the places that I've been, you know, the hospitality at the different places, you know, we've spoke earlier about the Blues, obviously about here, about Surrey Hall. You know, been to Liverpool, Tottenham, City, you know, not just football, but music and stuff like that. There's, everything happens for a reason, doesn't it? And I think it's all them little experiences. So don't get me wrong, we're not going to be Tottenham Hotspur and the big light show and the fireworks and all that type of stuff. But, you know, certainly within reason, within our level, I think we will do things slightly different to what the competition's doing. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. You know, we thought the same with Volcano, but obviously that didn't, but... I've got a belief that I think we'll do okay, and there's some really, really good people that work there, and you know, the guy that runs the youth is phenomenal. He absolutely loves it, and he 100% gets the way that youth football should be run. You know, youth football isn't about winning, it's about structuring, you know, and developing, and you know, and getting the kids into a position where they can make the absolute best of it. But you know, when I play football for Smithfield, I'm still best mates with some of the kids that I played football with. You know, probably all of my mates in life have come through football for one. Yeah, you know, you for football, and it's that type of thing that will get kind of instilled into these young kids. Hopefully, they'll have forever.
That about wraps us up then.
Yeah, boys.
Yeah, thanks for your time again, Gary.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your story. And best of luck in the future.
Amen.
All the best, guys. Cheers, bye.